Welcome all ye loyal heroes, and listen unto me. Don't hire with any farmer till you know what your work might be. For you must rise up early from the clear daylight till dawn, and you never will be able for to plough the rocks upon. Well, I started with that little tune this morning because sometimes I just want to be spontaneous, you know. Sometimes I just want to, like share what's in my heart in a particular moment. And I get this connection. If I'm on my own in the studio, my little studio is a little house in Donegal, but if I'm on my own in it, I'm completely alone in it now. And I feel you're there, you know. I feel there's a real sense that you are there. And then I sang because during the Christmas, on the day after St. Stephen's Day, I came to Donegal to do a workshop on singing. I was a student and the teacher was Máirne Wainey, who's the great singer in the group Alton. And it was a wonderful 4 days. And she taught us about 2 songs every day. That's 8 songs. You'd think I'd be able to go and give a concert by now. But of course, when you go back on your notes and you go back on the recordings you made, you realise that you can't sing any of them, you know. I thought I could sing, but I can't. But it was still great fun. And I suppose if I did practice them, I might improve. The one that really hit me in the heart was a beautiful thing called Ceol an Phibra, the music of the piper. Well, I says to myself, I'm going to learn that now. It might take me a week. And it's a week since I was doing the workshop. Do you think that I've learned it? Not at all. Haven't even opened it up. Another time I'd listen to it in the car. It's a lovely song, Ceol an Phibra. And it's a seductive enough song, you know. It's like the piper is saying to the young woman, or to the woman, he's saying, don't be marrying the tailor, and don't be marrying the ploughman, and don't be marrying the thrasher. Don't marry these people. And he gives the reasons why it's no value to be marrying people like that. You know, you'll be up all night fixing the loom, and you'll be out mucking yourself around in a field after a plough or something, you know. So, and at the end of each verse he says, Míle bardich mishagot, agus ceol bin mafiapi. Míle bardich. Far better for you, mishagot, to have me and the sweet music of me pipes. It's a very seductive song, and I'm nowhere near learning it, but I'll keep you posted over the next, probably take me 6 months to learn that. I was thinking I'd put it in a little theatre piece. I'd love to do a theatre piece in Irish. So I was thinking I might do that. I might even call it Ceol an Phibra. I think it's a lovely title for a piece of theatre. Like a one-man show, you know, and then I could go around the country and play the old piper. But the thing is that you'd need, when you're doing a one-man show like that and you have a story to tell and it's about the an Phibra, beautiful, wonderful fella, and seductive in his music and maybe in his looks, you realise, well, I can't play that. So I have to play something else. And then you look for some sort of contrast with the piper. Something magical that makes a contrast. And I heard this wonderful story. The story was that this particular famous piper in Donegal, his name was Maguire. And he was famous around the turn of the 19th century. Like from 19th to 20th century, I should say. Beginning of the 20th. And at the time, the clergy in this part of the world were very domineering and terrorizing, and they didn't like music. Well, they didn't like music, and they didn't like wakes, and they didn't like dances, and they didn't like mummers, and Lord God, there was an awful lot of things they didn't like. They must have been very crotchety, or their stomachs were very much out of tune with life. And so they'd be always going around with their blackthorn sticks, baiting people and giving off about young people in love, and giving off about dancing, and giving off about wakes that went on too long. And there was a piper, and the piper's name was Maguire, and Maguire was playing in a hall one night, and this was illegal. Like, this was, I don't know what kind of a hall it was now. I didn't get the full details of this, but he was playing in some hall, and he shouldn't have been playing there. And in come the parish priest, and he had a stick in his hand. The man's name, the priest's name, was McFadden, and the piper's name was Maguire. So in came McFadden, and he's swinging the stick, his stick in front of him, you know, flailing people that would be in front of him as he moved forward, slashing like you might slash the rushes with a slash hook. And he's slashing away at the people like that, and they scatter to every corner of the hall and vanish out doors and out windows, and just go until there's nobody left in the hall except himself, McFadden, the priest, and one other person sitting on the stage, the piper Maguire, sitting there with his pipes, nobody to play for. And the priest says to him, "Get out." And the piper says, "No, I'll not go, sir, till I'm paid." And he demanded to be paid. I think I heard 23 shillings, which was a huge amount of money in that time, maybe. Maybe it wasn't. That was just over a guinea, I suppose. Well, he demanded to be paid. And the priest couldn't get him out of the hall until he paid him, so he paid him. And there the story ended. Now, this story was told to me by somebody who heard it from their father or grandfather, and it's apparently a true story. But in some sense, it doesn't matter whether it's true exactly to the detail historically. It's powerfully true in its, you know, in its metaphor, in its metaphoric energy, in its symbolism, the clash of law and order with music. Law and order and authority being embodied in the figure of the feared priest. You know, the clerics as such came in after the Land League. And before the Land League achieved rights for farmers, small farmers, there was a huge amount of people had to pay rent, huge amount. And it pauperized them, and it kept them in poverty. And the image of the agent, who was the guy who'd collect the money for the landlord, the image of the agent was always that image of a man with a top hat and a fancy coat sitting on top of a big horse. And that would be the image. You'd see it in paintings, and you'd hear it in songs. In every parish in the country, that figure was moving around, the agent, and he wasn't a loved man. He wasn't endeared in the community. But once he left, because the Land League sorted out a certain amount of those problems, and once he left, what did you get instead? Almost like as an alternative, you got the local curate on a horse with a top hat. And that image begins to appear. And they situated themselves very neatly into rural Ireland in that way. Because you do have to remember 1829 was where Catholic emancipation was passed. So before then you had about 200 years of penal laws where there weren't that many priests, certainly none operating as a kind of a clerical system, a kind of an administrative system, a bureaucratic system, controlling births and marriages and deaths and all that sort of stuff wasn't so much like there was a huge kind of thing before the Catholic emancipation where Catholicism was very, very different. And then along comes Cardinal Cullen in the 1850s and 1860s, and the whole thing begins to change. It becomes a kind of a very bureaucratic administrative system, building churches all over the country. And the convents flooding with girls, flooding with young girls. Maybe a lot of them not by their own choice. And so by the end of that century, a century that you had the terrible trauma of the famine, and by the end of it, you have this new administrative caste or class who have taken over from where the landlord's agents left off. And now they're running the show, very different show, but they're controlling it with a very tight grip. And so they stamp out stuff like music and, you know, various rituals at wakes and weddings, and it just broke down a lot of indigenous culture, whether they knew it or not. I mean, I think it was all unintentional, to be quite honest. We have a tendency to look back in history and, you know, find fault with people as if they knew as much as we did and were doing everything bad with dark intentions. And I think most of the time they were doing, when they did bad things and dark things, it was because they too were in the dark. They didn't, as they used to say in the country, they didn't know any better. But it meant that you get this powerful image of the priest, MacFadden. And he's standing there in the hall and he's confronting, with his stick, he's confronting this big man. He was a big man, apparently, Maguire the Piper. And he's saying, "Get out." And your man is saying, "No, not till I'm paid." The reason why he was looking for the pay is that he came in the tradition of the bards. The bardic musicians would have had a lineage that went back 200-300 years, going back to Turlough O'Carolan and Art McCooey and Cathal Buimhigeolaguna, and, you know, great bardic traditions of poets and musicians, poets who were musicians, musicians who were poets. It was all kind of integrated, you know what I mean? They would sing their poems. Some of them had bands, like they'd have three or four musicians with them and they'd play in the big houses in the 1600s and 1700s. People like O'Carolan, they were going around big houses and they had bands. O'Carolan used to play a harp. It was made of brass strings. In those days, they didn't have the nice, you know, catgut strings of the 20th century. And to some extent, the harp in the 20th century sounds very, very kind of willowy and soft and kind of, you know, airy-fairy, you might say. Whereas when they were playing the harp in O'Carolan's time, the sound would have been much more like a harpsichord, much more like a kind of a mechanical early piano. Or sometimes, not unlike an electric guitar. And that's because they were doing dances, they were playing at dances in big houses where there might be 40 or 50 people in a huge, you know, hall in the big house. And they needed to be heard. And they'd have three or four or five musicians and various instruments, and O'Carolan would sing, or somebody else in his band would sing. I like to think of it like that, you know, like they were kind of a show band of their era. It makes them feel more real to me, those musicians. But they were a bardic class, and they went back to, if you take 1603, when the Battle of Kinsale ended the bardic tradition. It ended the chieftainry. It ended the whole chieftainry tradition. That's what happened at Kinsale, at that battle. And then from 1600 to 1649, you had this gradual encroachment, plantations, and breaking down the indigenous culture. And the famous Cromwell, on his march from Dundalk down south, you know, baiting the hell out of everybody and burning them and doing all sorts of depredation. In the name of the good religion, by the way. He was a devout Christian, thought he was doing good, getting rid of them old wicked tags. Again, in his own time, he thought he was doing good. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, it's not that they're thinking darkly. They're thinking like, oh, I'm doing good here. But they could be very misguided. You know, I think poor Mr. Cromwell was shocked and misguided, and an awful lot of people suffered. Anyway, you can see that before that time, when you had the chieftains, you also had the bardic tradition. And those bards were, you know, high up on the hierarchy of who was running the chieftainship. You might have the O'Reillys or the O'Rourkes, you might have the O'Donnells or the O'Neills, you might have, you know, chieftains all around the country. And whoever was the big boss man, he would have an entourage of administration and legal people and wise people. And that bardic tradition was the scholar, poets, judges who were in that tradition, who contributed by their poetry, by their music, by their judgments, by their wisdom. And those people would not have had rough hands. Their hands would have been pure as ivory, delicate little hands. Because they were musicians and scholars, and they were proud of it. And when all the bards lost their chieftains and had to go, as the poet said, Shiasamask Nanina, down among the people, when they had to end up knocking on the doors of farming homesteads, hoping they might get a job picking potatoes, hoping they might get a job maybe teaching Greek or Latin to the children in the house. Because that's where they ended up, on the hedge schools for a century. And composing poetry and writing music. And so that tradition was right there, right up until the 19th century. There was a remnant of it even at the start of the 20th century. People who were musicians and who saw themselves as aristocratic, saw themselves as elegant aristocrats in the great line of bardic poets. And I think Maguire was one of those on his pipes. He was no peasant in his own eyes. He was an aristocrat because he was an artist. He was a poet. He was a musician. This was a noble calling. And it's why I think in Ireland today there's a great value on art. There's a great value on music. There's a great value on poetry and literature. And there always has been. And I really, really think it's to do with the fact that we have a lineage goes back 300-400 years where when the poets and the artists were, you know, highly ranked in their society of Gaelic Ireland. And then they were pushed out and down among the people, and they spread among the people a sensibility that to be an artist, to be a writer, to be a poet was actually a nobility. It was a noble thing to be. It was an aristocratic thing to be. And so people valued and came to value poetry and art in Ireland in a huge way. And people like musicians that come at the end of the 19th century, start of the 20th century, they're like the bridge between the two eras, you know. Way back in the distance, you can imagine the 1550s, the 1590s, way back there. When Gaelic chieftains were in their castles, when they were importing wine from Spain. And they had their bards, their poets, their philosophers, their judges around them in an entourage. And then the crash comes at Kinsale, and that scholarly class of people end up knocking on the doors and trying to survive by teaching things like Greek to the children, because in that hedge school era, the peasant culture was intermingled with this extraordinary cast of artists and writers. And then come down to the late 19th century, early 20th century, and you see the remnant of them still. You see it in even the way sometimes, if you look at old photographs of this particular musician, Maguire, he's wearing a top hat. And sometimes you'll see somebody wearing, like, swallowtail dinner jacket, a musician. And it's like they still hold this memory that we are not peasants, we are musicians, we are artists. And it comes right the way up until the present day, when we celebrate, when I sometimes look at the amount of just Irish indigenous music and the way it has flourished under the creative genius of people like Sean O'Riordan. And now it flourishes among young groups and young musicians and Shano singers, and it's just all over the place, and it's absolutely magnificent. And the value that's set on it, the mass there is, you know, Tamás Ó Gomeran Rudchin, the mass people have in traditional Irish music and art, the mass and respect people have for Irish writers. I've been writing for 40 years. I know what respect people have for writers, and it really is a privilege. It's a privilege. It's just a blessing to live in a country like Ireland where writers are really revered. Like people love you. They come warmly to a writer. They embrace a writer. They hold them. They welcome them. They don't put them off or put them on a pedestal or treat them like posh. But they respect them. In every community. And so there's the story. And I'm looking at Maguire, this big man in his top hat with his pipes. And he's confronting the priest. And the priest is saying, get out of here. And he's saying, no, sir, not until you pay me. And that image comes to me like, wouldn't it be great to write a play about that, you know? Like a one-man show, because I can't do the piper. I'm not, I can never play the romantic, beautiful, wonderful lead. I can only play and always play either the comic, the fool, or the dark, you know. The unloved Grinch is more the space psychically that I fit into as a performer. So what you do in this case is you tell one person's story through the other lens. So you play not the piper, if you were making a one-man show out of it, but you play the priest. The ugly, nasty one. He may not have been in real life ugly or nasty, but this is just in the mythic shape of telling a story. He's the villain. The villain. And you play the villain, but you have the villain tell the story of the musician. And that's how it works. That's how you get to make a beautiful person come alive on stage. Because he's never on stage. It's the villain is talking about him. Now that was a kind of a workshop. I hope you enjoyed it. And it was just an entirely spontaneous workshop that came out of the fact that I started singing a few verses of a song. And I didn't sing them that well either. I'm aware of that. I'm almost embarrassed to put it out as a podcast when I'm singing, because I'm not singing well. I'm not doing it well. But there's the shape of something that might happen in the next 6 months for me. And maybe now that I've spoken about it, it'll never happen, because I've always had a great belief in the fact that if you talk about work you're going to do, you end up not doing it. You talk about doing it and then you don't do it. So I'd be a bit nervous of that. But we'll see how it goes. In the meantime, I just wanted to share. And I'll tell you why I wanted to share. Because it's the 5th of January. And tomorrow is Nulog Naman. It's the end of Christmas. But in some way for me, it's the beginning of Christmas. It's like really a special day. And I'm going to talk about that next in a separate podcast. So for now, thank you for sharing this little meandering meditation on how to write a play. And have a wonderful, wonderful day. Have a wonderful weekend for Nulog Naman. And have a beautiful New Year. Bye-bye.